conditions, the metal was sold for just £32,000. BBC News.
Now on Radio 4, it's time for the first omnibus edition of Plants, From Roots to Riches. A chance to catch up with the first few episodes in our major new history series broadcast earlier this year, in which Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science of the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, examines our changing relationship with plants. Over the next five Fridays, she draws upon Kew's collections and scientific research, both past and present. And Cathy begins her journey at the entrance to one of the garden's most popular buildings.
Walk through the main gates into Kew Gardens and you can't miss the Palm House. It's a glass cathedral to plants. Go inside and a massive towering figure looms up to greet you. It's in front of me now, in fact, or rather, I'm dwarfed underneath it. It's a cycad, a palm-like tree with bark patterned in a mosaic of diamond shapes on the trunk. Its branches are spreading 4 metres above ground. In fact, it's almost touching the roof. To me, as an evolutionary biologist, it's an astonishing and remarkable plant. For one thing, it belongs to a group of plants that has an incredible time span. Cycads have been around for almost 280 million years. This means they've survived multiple climate changes, outlived the dinosaurs, and predate most mammals. This particular exhibit is also remarkable because it's probably older than Kew Gardens. It claims to be the oldest pot plant in the world, and even older than the system of naming plants as we currently know it. Greg Redwood, you're Kew's keeper of the glasshouses. What's the name of this cycad?
This is Encephalartus oldensteinii. It's usually cited as the oldest glasshouse plant in the world. I like it because its age makes you realise how insignificant people are in their lifespan. When this plant came to Kew in 1775, it was already of a fair age, so it's well over 200 years old. And I do like to remind our American visitors that it's older than the United States of America.
Emma Townsend, as a volunteer guide here at Kew, how do visitors react to their first encounter with this cycad?
For a lot of people, the first thing they do is get out their camera because it's a pretty spectacular composition with the big traveller's palm behind. And visitors are always entranced by the story of how old the plant is. George III would have seen this plant, Queen Victoria would have seen this plant, and any other famous visitor.
Darwin, presumably, would have looked at this plant.
I think it's got the whole history of Kew bound up in it.
I don't know how much longer it's got to go, but it will certainly outlive me.
So, Emma, how did it get here?
It had been collected in South Africa by a man called Francis Masson, who was Kew's very first live plant collector. And he brought back, in the end, something like 500 species that were new to science. Wow. It would have probably taken 4 or 5 months to sail all the way back around the west coast of Africa, Canaries, back to the Port of London, and then it would have been disembarked onto a barge and then come up to Kew.
This cycad has been an evergreen witness to the evolution of botany as a scientific discipline and Kew's role in it. From a gentleman's hobby to a science encompassing the classification of plants, their physiology, distribution, economic importance, ecology, and genetics. And even now, plants continue to arrive here from all over the world. Our understanding and our relationship with plants has been flowering quite literally here in West London for over 250 years. It's where much of what we know about scientific botany began, and it's all still here. Not just the history, but modern plant science, giving us vital information about how our world has changed, is changing, and responding to the challenges we're throwing at it. And it's what I'm going to be exploring with the help of the pioneers, the people, and above all, the plants. At the time our cycad arrived in Kew, England was consumed by exploration, enlightenment, and conquest. One of the results was a vast influx, a tsunami of completely unknown species from all over the world. The challenge for European plant naturalists was, to put it mildly, considerable. Specimens weren't just arriving from English settlements in North America, India and the Caribbean. The Dutch were also sending the fruits of their conquests here too, from Japan, South America, South Africa and the East and West Indies. What do you do with all this botanical material, especially if the most up-to-date plant lists you have were drawn up in ancient Greece? Jim Endersby is our historical advisor to the series and science historian at Sussex University. As he explains, the botanical world was on the point of chaos.
In the Western tradition, which dates back to Theophrastus, a pupil of Aristotle's, he works in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean is relatively poor in species. He named around 500 species of plants in his works. And the number of species known to men of science working in the West grows and grows. So by the 17th century, we have John Ray, one of the first to study botany systematically at Cambridge, knows of about 17,000 species. And he makes that contrast, the comparison with Theophrastus, quite explicitly in his work.
And how are they named?
Well, that was a source of great confusion. Virtually every director of a botanic garden, every collector and student of plants had their own system of names. So in fact, it was impossible to know how many species there were because no two experts would agree, no two used the same system.
Sounds very muddled.
It was. There was a botanical Tower of Babel, and there was a very real sense in which no two botanists knew what they were talking about when they corresponded with one another, because they would have their own local names, often their own local scholarly system, and they would often be speaking or writing in different languages too.
One man was acutely aware of this problem. Passionate about plants from his early childhood, the Swedish naturalist Carl Linnaeus had explored, collected and codified the plant life of his native Lapland. Naming plants and animals was a task to which he was to dedicate his life.
The names bestowed by the ancient Greeks and Romans I commend, but I shudder at the sight of most of those given by modern authorities. A rustic knows plants, and so maybe does a brute beast, but neither can make anyone else the wiser.
Linnaeus realised that without a proper system of names, botanical knowledge simply gets lost. A rose by any other name might smell as sweet, but you can't tell anyone else to go and enjoy it unless you have a name which everyone can use to recognise it. His stroke of genius was to classify plants according to two-part Latin names or binomials, a species and then a genus.
The botanist is, therefore, distinguished from the layman in that he can give a name which fits one particular plant and not another, and which can be understood by anyone all the world over.
So, our large friend in the palm house, the cycad, for example, has, like every other animal and plant, two names. The genus name Encephalatos, that is derived from the Greek and means bread in the head. This refers to the ancient practice of removing the pith from the cycad stem and kneading it into bread. And a species name, Altensteinii, in homage to the 19th century German chancellor, Altenstein. So what Linnaeus devised was not just a way of naming living things, but a way of understanding them and putting them into a standardised hierarchy that he hoped would help uncover the machinery of nature, deciphering, as so many of his predecessors had attempted, the blueprint of creation. And as a typical Enlightenment improver, he confidently told his Scandinavian patrons and the general public alike that science would not only serve our understanding of God's ways, but also the economic needs of the state.
The Swedes can learn. The Lap is our teacher, as he said, because they are pure, simple people. There's a sort of classic 18th century notion of a noble savage at work here. People who live a natural Swedish life. And his problem is that the rest of Sweden lives a distinctly decadent life. He feels that basically Sweden is bankrupting itself by importing all these foreign luxuries, spending its limited resources of silver and bullion, and will end up as an impoverished country. The solution, of course, is plants. Okay. If he can find the exotic plants, like tea, and bring them to Sweden and grow them there, Sweden will become self-sufficient. He has a great deal of difficulty finding the right plants, which is one of the things that motivates him to clarify plant names, of course. Several times they try and get tea and get the wrong thing. But he never gives up. He brings these things, he plants them, ginger and rice. They all die in a Swedish climate. But he actually says, if coconuts should chance to come into my hands, it would be as if fried birds of paradise flew into my mouth when I opened it. This lust for exotic tropical novelties never leaves him. But this project of trying to make Sweden economically self-sufficient is really one of the things that drives his whole project, to find a single uniform system of names for the plants.
So a lot of people mistakenly identify Linnaeus for the whole binomial classification of plants, but that's not quite correct, is it?
Not quite, no. Linnaeus is quite well read and he understands what's going on in the plant world around him. And what he does is he pulls together strands from other people's works. So it's actually Gaspar Bohan in Basel who's the first to use binomials, two-part names. Linnaeus takes those and he adds bits and pieces of other systems as well, the work of Joseph Piton de Tournefort in Paris, and particularly the work of Rudolf Camerarius, who's the first person to really write about the sexuality of flowers. And it's that that gives Linnaeus the idea that, well, if they're sexually reproducing, they must have sex organs. And this will be a consistent part that every plant must have that we could take as the basis of a classification system.
And its beauty is its clarity and simplicity. To use it, all you had to do was count the reproductive organs. The number of stamens, or husbands as he called them, determined its class, and the number of pistils or carpels defined its order. A beginner could do it. Linnaeus also produced a beautifully laid out book to explain it, the System Naturae, or System of Nature.
This was published in 1735. It covers the rocks and the minerals and the plants and the animals.
Gina Douglas is a Linnaean scholar who guided me through the floral section of its first edition. So how many plant groups did he have then?
He had 23. The 24th was one where you couldn't really see what was going on. Those were the mosses and the lichens and the seaweeds where things were hidden, the hidden marriages, he called them. He's got this tabular arrangement of things, initially by the number of stamens.
So we've got Monandria are. Here, which is a single stamen.
Yes, one husband. The husbands come first, and then within the husband groupings, there are the number of wives.
Right the way through to multiple.
It's many marriages,
Marriages. So this is a fantastically simple system in many ways. I can imagine using this myself in the field. You go in there, you take the flower, you break it down, you count the number of stamens.
And that would give you your major class you put it in.
This was a tool, a useful way of getting more plants, more specimens, getting some uniformity into the names that would lead gradually to a more natural system. At the time, the Comte de Buffon, who is one of Linnaeus's critics, he's the director of the King's Cabinet and Garden in Paris, actually mocks Linnaeus for the fact that you have to climb to the top of some vast tree and count the stamens in its flowers in order to discover that it's related to the insignificant weed growing in the grass at its feet. Because, of course, they're not related at all. They're utterly unrelated. But in Linnaeus's system, they end up being lumped together because of a numerical coincidence. And even though aspects of Linnaeus's system have been abandoned, the key insights of having simple standardized names remain the foundation of modern scientific taxonomy. And that's really what Linnaeus gave us.
Victorian naturalists now had the confidence to hunt for new species. Crucially, they had a grammar for plants, a language for flowers. Armed with Linnaeus's system of naming, it's tempting to think that aspiring naturalists were now ready to conquer and classify the botanical world. But without any great institution to train them or hold collections, the reputation of Linnaeus and his system hung in the balance.
Plants to shape society.
Deep below the buses and scurrying footsteps of London's Piccadilly is a vault, built during the Cold War.
Doesn't creak, but it's quite a massive door.
Which plays host to a priceless collection.
And then you go through an airlock, as it were, to keep the dust out.
My goodness. This is the collection assembled by Carl Linnaeus, Swedish taxonomist and champion of giving all living things just two names. It's mind-boggling just how much stuff there is down here. Fortunately for me, Linnaean archivist Gina Douglas knows her way around.
These are all Linnaeus's original plant specimens, 14,000 of them, 3,000 insect specimens, about 3,000 or more shells, plus dried fish, all of which came to London in late 1784.
How did they get here? I mean, why are they in London underneath Piccadilly?
Well, Linnaeus himself died in 1778. And after a bit of family wrangling, his son inherited the collection, but his son then went on to die in 1783. And his mother, who'd been landed with all this stuff, needed to raise money to bring up her daughters and their families. She also needed someone who was going to safeguard it, because she knew that unless it was well looked after, it would just rot away. So she contacted Sir Joseph Banks, who'd just about taken on a role of de facto director of Kew at that time. And it just so happened that on that day there was a young medical student, James Edward Smith, with a wealthy father, having breakfast with him. Banks decided that he didn't need to take on Linnaeus's collection. He'd already got a lot of things of his own he was involved with. But he suggested to Smith, this young man, that he buy the collection, and that would make his name.
Everyone wanted this collection. The Empress of Russia was just one of several parties itching to get possession of it if James Edward Smith declined, but he didn't. He got the funds from his father, and the books and specimens were loaded on board a ship bound for England. In some ways, his purchase was rather like the vast investment recently made by Sir Joseph Banks, the great patron of the natural sciences. Banks had financed James Cook's botanical expedition to the South Pacific on board the ship Endeavour out of his personal fortune. By doing so, Banks had built up a national botanical treasure. He'd become something of a national treasure himself, a public figure and an ambassador and statesman of science. Now, Smith's purchase, like Banks's journey, was a pivotal moment in botanical history, not least because if you have so much stuff, you have to have a reliable and scientific way of working out what to call it. For the first time, Britain had enough material to promote the Linnaean system of classification.
There's an apocryphal story that the Swedes realised too late that the collection was leaving Sweden and sent a gunboat after the British ship to pursue it, but it is an apocryphal tale. We've no real foundation for that. Smith, who bought the collections, very quickly founded the Linnaean Society, which is where we are now, and he was very keen on promoting the Linnaean system, and Sir Joseph Banks, in turn, had looked kindly on the founding of the Linnaean Society. He considered that there was a need for a venue to discuss advances in botany and zoology, and the Linnaean system provided the framework under which those discussions and new discoveries were published and made available to the world.
Armed with this great treasure, Smith championed the Linnaean system for the rest of his life. He was following in a direct line of descent from the Linnaean's original go-to guy, Joseph Banks. Using Linnaeus's brand new grammar for plants, this great botanical impresario had amassed and identified a whopping 3,900 specimens on board the Endeavour. Luckily, Banks wasn't interested in koalas or kangaroos, or the ship would have sunk. Back in London, his home in Soho Square became his own herbarium of dried plants and the storehouse of his newly systematised knowledge. Banks had, in effect, increased the number of known plant species by 25%. He now had the ear of King George III and learned men across Europe. Banks was convinced that Britain's destiny was as the major civilising power in the world. He believed that this role could be achieved by harnessing science, particularly botany, and imperial progress to each other's mutual benefit. Historian Jim Endersby.
One could say, well, Banks is really interested in power and political power and influence and so on. You could say he's really interested in agricultural improvement, or he's really interested in science. Actually, I think he's equally interested in all these things. But certainly part of the Linnaean project that appeals to Banks is this idea of improvement. Linnaeus wanted to bring rare and unusual plants to Sweden, acclimatise them, reduce Sweden's dependence on imports. Banks has a similar kind of vision. And it's a vision, really, of improving the world. Improvement is an extraordinarily powerful and important idea in Britain, particularly at this time. And it really goes to the notion of common land. A lot of land in Britain at this period is still commonly owned, and anyone can use it. You can take your goose or your goat down to the common and graze it. The worry that people like Banks have is that nobody owns the commons. Nobody looks after them. Nobody improves them. Nobody's going to manure them, drain them, ditch them and hedge them and so on. And this fear of worthless waste ground and an inability to feed a rising population encourages Banks and people like him to put enclosure acts through Parliament which enclose common land and make it into private land so that somebody will look after it. So this is very much how Banks sees the world, as a series of waste grounds, common lands, waiting to be enclosed, waiting to be improved. So he encourages, for example, the East India Company to create botanic gardens in India, to find out what grows in India, which is a valuable crop that can be exported to other places, but also how new plants can be acclimatized and introduced into India. This is a very Linnaean project.
And Banks' evangelists went out into all lands, such as Francis Masson to the Cape of Good Hope, Alan Cunningham and James Bowie to South America. In the first two decades of the 19th century, these botanists furnished our gardens with many beautiful specimens whose descendants are still here today. From Masson, geraniums, and the bird of paradise flower Strelitzia, from Cunningham, many species of eucalyptus, acacia and pittosporum. And to his collectors, he gave strict instructions.
When you meet with curious or valuable plants, which you do not think likely to be propagated from seeds in His Majesty's garden, you are to dig up proper specimens of them, plant them in the glass frame provided for that purpose, and use your utmost endeavours to preserve them alive till your return.
These explorers would bring back to Kew previously untapped resources. Raw garden staff and visiting botanists alike could then poke, probe and propagate the plants of the world right here in southwest London. But as well as getting busy in the potting shed, Banks's ultimate ambition for Kew was as a botanical exchange house between the colonies. Plants could be at the centre of a new kind of global capitalism, and with Kew as its engine room, Britain, he envisaged, would rule the commercial waves.
I think in a perfect world, Banks would have liked the botanical empire centred on Kew to exercise real control over the colonial gardens, that valuable plants from one colony would be shipped to another colony where they could be grown profitably, and this ideal of improvement could be realised through the network of gardens. But it's important to understand that this is a vision that will not be achieved in Banks's time. The beginnings of a network of botanic gardens will be set up, but in a very haphazard way. Communication with Australia, for example, takes months and months. There's no way Banks or anyone else can really give directions. By the time a letter of instructions has arrived in Sydney, it's quite possible that the person to whom it was addressed is already dead and somebody else is running the gardens. This actually happens. So there's a very limited degree of control over this burgeoning botanical empire. To a large extent, all these colonial gardens are independent. And they largely communicate with one another through a totally haphazard mechanism of giving any passing ship's captain a packet of seeds and a letter of introduction and sending him off to the next botanic garden, which may be in a British colony or maybe in a French one or maybe somewhere else altogether.
And we can perhaps see why Banks's vision for Kew didn't come to pass if we think about what happened to his own collections.
When he dies in 1820, they don't go to Kew. Kew doesn't have a library, it doesn't have a herbarium, and it doesn't have anyone to look after them. Those specimens go to the British Museum. And with them goes Robert Brown, the dour Scottish botanist who has actually been living and working at Soho Square with Banks all these years. Banks basically makes a deal with the nation, give my faithful servant a job for life as keeper of these collections, and they will become the nation's collections. And that herbarium, the Banksian herbarium, is of course still there, at what is now the Natural History Museum. And Kew is rather sidelined. Kew is left without a master, without anyone really to care for it, without a herbarium, perhaps even without a future.
Banks's life and work embodied the interconnection of modern science, commerce and empire. But by the start of the 19th century, studying plants meant many things to many different people. Botany served Banks in several ways, not least a route to political power and influence. For many, though, it was a diversion for the Enlightenment mind, an inquiry into God's handiwork and a chance to worship as you investigate what God has made. For others, it was a matter of the purest curiosity. What are plants? How do they grow? The roots of this spirit of intellectual inquiry were taking hold below ground. Its riches were just about to flower.
Pressed plants and possibilities.
Oh, where is this from? Oh, this is from Biocco. That's so cool.
Every week, large paper packages tied up with string arrive at the gates of Kew. They come from all over the world and contain plant specimens usually squashed between sheets of local newspaper. And they're definitely some of the taxonomists' favourite things.
Kind of on the edge of my seat at the moment because I'm waiting for nearly 100 kilos of specimens.
They could be new, as yet unnamed species, or something that may turn out to have a revolutionary use in medicine or agriculture or commerce, or provide vital information to support conservation.
Incoming material goes into the freezers on a Monday and it goes into the clean area on a Friday.
Once they emerge free of bugs, It's then the job of taxonomists such as tropical palm specialist Bill Baker to identify them.
It's quite shocking, actually, when you look around here to see quite the volume of material coming in.
If they turn out to be a newly discovered species, they're also given a name. It's the essential starting point to classifying them and placing them on the plant family tree.
This is really the exploration of the unknown plant world.
Identifying, classifying and naming specimens was one of the most important breakthroughs for botanical scientists. As we've been hearing, it began with Carl Linnaeus in the 18th century, and in the decades that followed, plants were sought out across the empire for trade, medicine and old-fashioned showing off. But as the Victorians well knew, preserving the structural feature of the plant, the shape, position of the stem, leaves, flowers and the fruit was essential. One thing that never ceases to amaze me is that this process has remained virtually unchanged for the past 250 years. Then, as now, each specimen is dried and mounted on standard-sized pieces of paper. Their destination? The herbarium. Jim Endersby, as a historian of science, as well as historical advisor to this series, you've made many visits to this resource centre. To me, it looks like a Victorian prison. You've got these big red iron columns, and where you'd expect the cells to open out, where people can lean over and look down onto the ground floor, you've actually got multiple cupboards with herbarium sheets in them.
Yeah, it's funny you think it looks like a prison. It always makes me think of a sort of inside-out greenhouse, because it's got Victorian cast iron pillars and it contains plants like a greenhouse, but these ones are all dried and they've come from all over the world, collected by an extraordinary range of people over hundreds of years. And this is really a crucial reference library for the work of Kew. If you want to know what a plant is, this is where you come.
Dave Simpson, you're the keeper of this herbarium. How many plant species, dried plant species, do we have in here?
Well, we've got about 7 million dry plant specimens. The majority of our specimens have come in from mid-19th century onwards and continue to do so at a rate of about 37,000 per year.
We have in front of us here a herbarium sheet, and I see it has Darwin's name on the bottom left-hand corner.
This one was collected on Darwin's voyage of the Beagle. What we have on the sheet is a species of grass, Poa ligularis. It's a relative of a very common grass that we get in the UK. We can look in detail at the flowers. We can look at the chemistry of the plant. We can look at the internal structure of it. And we can even extract the DNA from it. And using that sequence of DNA and comparing it to other related plants, we can then build up an understanding of the overall relationships between the plants.
Extracting DNA from herbarium specimens is a more recent development. But the underlying idea of a collection of dried plants at Kew was a vision of the gentleman amateur botanist William Jackson Hooker. Hooker was largely self-taught, a rising star who made his reputation on identifying mosses. In 1810, at the age of 25, he was appointed Regius Professor of Botany at Glasgow University. It was Hooker who lobbied hard for a herbarium as a much-needed scientific adjunct at Kew, but like everything else, it was dependent on the vagaries of public opinion, patronage and money. In the years following the deaths of George III and Sir Joseph Banks, Kew's sense of purpose rapidly diminished. Without its favourite mad monarch to take his pleasure there, the role of the Royal Gardens seemed less apparent.
So what's happened by the 1830s is various British colonies have got botanical gardens, and they've been set up in all kinds of ad hoc ways. And John Lindley, an ambitious young botanist involved in the Horticultural Society, professor at University College London, writes about the fact that these gardens exist, but they're kind of useless because nobody is collecting the plants and the information they have. So there may be all these valuable plants, spices and timber, dyes and medicines and so on, all over the empire, all of which could be grown much more profitably if only we knew what was there. And he uses this to argue that the government should take Kew over from the royal family, turn it into a proper national botanic garden. Lindley, of course, has himself in mind as the director of Kew, and he loses out. The government's desire for retrenchment, as they would put it, austerity measures, drives this agenda as ever, and William Hooker gets the job because he's willing to come for a lower salary.
I regard not any reasonable expense, and am determined, as far as lies in my power, to make my herbarium the richest of any private one in Europe.
And William Hooker was very canny about acquiring other people's collections. He would buy them, he would get them as gifts, he would have people leave them to Kew. But having the specimens as the first step towards bringing order to the chaos of novelty that was threatening to overwhelm Europeans.
So what happens then to that chaos? How does the novelty get produced into order?
Well, basically it comes here and it gets put into cupboards. And these cupboards at Kew contain the classification. The cupboards represent the families of plants. The folders represent the genera. Each genus has its own folder. And each sheet is a species. And there are various levels to the hierarchy originally established by Linnaeus.
So we have in front of us here one that was collected by Hooker himself.
Indeed. William Hooker collected in Scotland 1827, Primula scotica. It's a tiny little plant, picked and dried, annotated and changed over the year. This one hasn't had its name changed, but many specimens do. And what happens is the species name, for whatever reason, is crossed out and the sheet is moved to a new folder in a new cupboard. And as you reclassify plants, that's what happens to them. They move around. So part of the work of the herbarium, part of the work of classifying plants, is in fact keeping track of 7 million and more separate pieces of paper.
Keeping track of things is what the Victorians did well. They loved order and hierarchy. Their own world was regulated into a divinely sanctioned system of aristocrats, merchants and labourers, of Britain and the colonies, of Christians and heathens. Plants had the same sense of order, and the herbarium was a physical manifestation of this hierarchy. With such an order, built up over centuries, patterns emerge. So today this is no longer just a repository of dried and pressed plants, but as Bill Baker describes, an invaluable and unique scientific tool.
It's a reference to what plants occur where on the face of the earth. And that allows us to look at how their distributions have changed over time. So we can see from looking at modern records versus old records how distributions have shrunk due to habitat destruction. And we can use these specimens as data points in analyses to really quantify the extinction threat that's being faced by these species.
Can we use the past records to then enable us to predict future patterns and changes?
Yeah, of course we can, because, for example, a botanist, when they make a specimen, they'll record whether the plant was in flower or not, and they'll record what date it was collected. So we have an individual data point about flowering time. And we all know that flowering time is affected by climate. So we actually have a reference collection here that tracks back over time. And if analysed properly and modelled appropriately, we can start to see trends from those data in changes in flowering time that might then be correlated with known changes in climate. It all depends on the quality of the modelling, but one thing that can't be beaten is the quality of the data point from a place like Kew.
To a scientist, a herbarium specimen is central to research, but William Hooker was also aware that in an age when empire was aiming to show everything to its best advantage, the challenge was how to display the order and hierarchy of plants to a curious Victorian public. The answer lay with Kew's first Museum of Economic Botany, as researcher Caroline Cornish explains.
The idea was, and you see it in other 19th century museums, where if a museum is laid out according to a certain theoretical perspective, that as you walk through in the prescribed order, and there was a particular order that you would follow one case to the next, that you would actually be, in this case, embodying that taxonomic system. The other thing was that, and Hooker sort of articulated this, that if you knew the basic properties of a certain family, for example, you know, he would say, well, the poppy family are narcotic. Then if you came across a plant you didn't recognise, you could work out what its properties might be. You could say, that looks like something which I know to be poisonous, or I know to have a useful fibre, or to have certain medicinal properties. So it was the idea that the public could then extrapolate. Plants and plant products were arriving at the docks in Britain daily, flooding in, and often the merchants didn't even know what they were. So the museum was able to really showcase this influx of new species.
Showcasing the rich botanical diversity of the empire was not only educational, but also reminded society just how far their reach extended around the globe. However, botany's claim to economic importance depended on its ability to transport crops around the colonies,
for people to cultivate, use and eat. Why did species constantly fail in some places and not others? Why did some die on the journey and others survive? It was becoming vital to understand the complex relationship between geography, botany and climate. And as we'll hear, there was a serious problem emerging with pests and disease.
Blight on the landscape.
Summer 1845 began in a blaze of sunshine. In Ireland, crops prospered as they had for many years. The potato harvest looked set to provide enough food and more for the growing population of the country. Then, the skies broke. A wet autumn turned into a wetter winter. Potato plants rotted in the mud. Irish peasants watched aghast as for two consecutive winters, the crop failed. Anthony Trollope summed up the horror in his novel Castle Richmond.
For many, many years preceding and up to that time, the increasing swarms of the country had been fed upon the potato, and upon the potato only. And now, all at once, the potato failed them, and the greater part of 8 million human beings were left without food. The destruction of the potato was the work of God, and it was natural to attribute the sufferings which at once overwhelmed the unfortunate country to God's anger, to his wrath for the misdeeds of which that country had been guilty. For myself, I do not believe in such exhibitions of God's anger.
Whether God had a hand in it or not, the appalling tragedy gave scientists the opportunity to study firsthand the stinking mass of rotten potatoes and the mysterious smuts of fungus covering the leaves. The science of plant pathology was born. Infectious microorganisms would finally become accepted as a cause of disease rather than its result, predating even Louis Pasteur's work with bacteria. The blurring of science and religion at this time was exemplified in the man chosen to compile a report on this devastating disease and who came to be known as the founding father of fungi, the Reverend M.J. Berkeley. He was the first to recognise a potential link between the smuts of fungus on leaves and potato blight. His extensive personal collection of fungal specimens forms the foundation of Kew's Fungarium, which today houses over 1 million specimens. It serves as a reference library for studies of conservation and ecology of fungi, and it includes some of the original specimens of potato blight used by Berkeley himself. Bryn Dentinger is head of mycology at Kew.
On the leaf, you can see these brown spots, and if you were to look at it under a microscope, the difference in the colour between the brown and the greenish-brown of the dried leaves would be a lot more distinct. And it's these spots that represent the decay that the blight is causing as a result of infection from the Phytophthora, the late blight.
In these early fungarium specimens, what were they looking for?
Well, they were looking at the microscopic structures of fungi. You could observe an organism that was composed of filaments, and these resembled the filaments of fungi. And because other fungi had been observed from diseased plants, the connection was made by Berkeley that this was probably the cause of disease.
It fell to Anton de Bary, a German botanist, to perform the experiments that settled the debate. In our modern age of established scientific process, it's easy to regard de Bary's work as relatively primitive, but this would be to misunderstand just how forward-looking his ideas were in an age still largely wedded to the idea of spontaneous generation and natural disasters as an act of God's revenge. De Bary exposed potato plants to the cool, wet environmental conditions that favoured blight. To some plants, he applied sporangia from blighted plants, but others he kept as control plants and applied no fungal spores. This is proper modern science. Even though both sets of plants were exposed to the same environment, only the plants inoculated with the fungus became blighted. So it was clear that the plants did not rot away because they absorbed too much water, as had been thought. Another ingredient was needed. No spores, no disease.
He was particularly skilled at using a microscope and thinking experimentally. What he brought to the field of mycology that hadn't been there before was really an obsession with understanding development of organisms so that you could link different parts of their life cycle and therefore understand not only how they might be related to other organisms, but what they're doing.
So it was really that meticulous, tedious study of life cycles and the structures that make up those life cycles that allowed him to propose convincingly to the rest of the world that the fungus that was associated with late blighted potato was the cause of the disease.
So what were these tiny but lethal spores, animal or plant? When not fruiting, where did they go? How did they reproduce? To answer these pressing questions, careful observation and recording of fungi was needed. Some of the first, most important and beautiful pictures of these mysterious life forms can be found in what might be a surprising source. You might even have some on your bookshelves, the works of Beatrix Potter. Her nature pictures are exquisite. They provided some extraordinary insights that eluded other scientists at the time. One example, Potter drew the first record of the fungus Tremella simplex in Britain. She painted the fruiting bodies, the basidiospores, and all other parts at all ages in the fungus life cycle. Look at her Peter Rabbit books, and if you know your fungi, you'll recognise many in her beautiful illustrations. Historian Jim Endersby.
Beatrix Potter's earliest interest was in fact in natural history illustration. One of the things that she was the first to do was to actually successfully germinate spores of particular fungi. And as a result of these very meticulous observations, she became interested in the lichens. We've all seen them, scrubby-looking, strange brown, grey, black things that you find on rocks. There are massive numbers of them. And they were a puzzle in the 19th century. A German naturalist, Schwendener, had put forward the idea that they were a symbiotic organism, that they're a fungus and an algae. And Potter, from her observations, became convinced that the German was right. And she became one of the first British proponents of this new theory. One British naturalist, James Crombie, in 1874, ridiculed the whole idea as an unnatural union between a captive algal damsel and a tyrant fungal master. And the fact that Potter, like most women in science in the 19th century, had a lot of trouble being taken seriously. The fact that she had attached her name to this rather outlandish theory didn't help her get a fair hearing for her ideas.
In her zeal to find out the truth about lichens, Beatrix Potter set about cultivating both the algal cells and the fungal spores for herself in her own kitchen. She observed how the two partners joined to form one organism. But many scientists still failed to take Potter seriously.
The best place in the world to present the kind of work she was doing would have been the Linnaean Society of London. Women were not admitted as members. Her work, when it was finally presented in 1897, had to be read on her behalf by George Massey, one of the botanists from Kew, a man that Potter was not terribly impressed with.
I opine that he had passed several stages of development into a fungus himself.
After the paper was presented, Potter actually withdrew it from publication because she wasn't satisfied that her evidence was quite complete. She went back to do more microscopical observation and actually never ended up publishing that paper at all. Generally speaking, the 19th century, and I think Darwin's influence is quite important here, people tended to view the relationships between organisms as competitive. You were either eaten or you were one of the eaters. So the idea that two organisms could live together in harmony, neither one parasitic on the other, but them mutually beneficial, was a really strange and unfamiliar idea. It's one that's actually become a very important part of how we view the natural world in the 20th century. But in the 19th, it was still very rare.
The nature of these relationships is the subject of intense research amongst mycologists. So far, only 10,000 species of fungi have been described. That sounds a lot, but it probably represents only about 10% of the total number of fungi out there. As Bryn Dentinger explains, this branch of science is still in its infancy.
We know today, for example, that you can have a couple hundred species of fungi in a single gram of soil. But we know that because we can sequence their DNA, not because we've ever observed them. But there has been a major revolution in technologies that have enabled us to access DNA sequences, and more recently, even whole genomes of organisms, even from really old material, like a specimen of a blighted potato plant from 1845. we can now compare whole genomes between historical and contemporary specimens and see differences. It was thought for a long time that the organism that caused the late blight of potato in the 19th century was similar to the strain that's causing blight today in our potato fields. And it turns out, using genome comparisons, it was a unique strain that existed for about 50 years. So having the technology like genomics that allows us to access this kind of information from historical and contemporary specimens allows us really to understand how those changes have taken place in the past in different contexts.
Potato blight was a tragic disaster for the people of Ireland, but studying its effects firsthand provided the best possible opportunity to protect against future outbreaks. It also drove a new science, plant pathology. And as the 19th century reached its midpoint and the British Empire continued its unstoppable march across the globe, the disaster was to highlight what happens when plants move far from their origins and the need to understand the distribution of economically important plants.
Lumping and splitting.
It was by the middle of the 19th century that identifying and classifying of plants had become recognised as being far more important than mere list-making. It became the biggest issue in 19th century science. What species is this, and where does it come from? These questions occupied the world-travelled naturalist Joseph Hooker. He was the son of the director of Kew Gardens, William Hooker. His botanical enthusiasms developed early, sitting in on his father's lectures and travelling widely, both collecting and classifying plants. By the 1850s, his interest had also turned to their distribution. And following a botanising trip to Antarctica, he was to strike up a lifelong correspondence with the century's most celebrated naturalist.
My own interest in Joseph Hooker began with a famous letter of Darwin's, in which he describes believing in evolution, transmutation as it was known at the time, as being like confessing a murder. This was written to Joseph Hooker, and it's only about the second letter they ever exchanged. They barely knew each other. I think they'd met once, fleetingly, at this point.
Historian Jim Endersby is the author of Imperial Nature, a biography of Joseph Hooker.
Darwin was something of a hero to the younger man already, and he very much had that kind of trajectory in mind for himself. You would travel, explore, come home, describe your collections, and make a name for yourself. And I thought, well, what was so amazing about Hooker that Darwin trusted him with this biggest of all big secrets? And he becomes the very first man of science anywhere in the world to publicly come out in support of Darwin.
Jim, you've brought me into the herbarium where we're surrounded by these sheets of dried specimens from across the globe. How was this collection central to Joseph Hooker's enterprise of mapping vegetation across the world?
He can survey the variation in plants across the globe without leaving this room. And that allows him to see the patterns of distribution, what grows where and why, and begin to work out the causal mechanisms that underpin those relationships.
So he starts to look at things like temperature and precipitation, the sort of climatic factors, is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. Building on the work of the great German Alexander von Humboldt, who had mapped the vegetation of the Andes. Humboldt notices things that as you climb a mountain, obviously green plants get scarcer and scarcer, and eventually you have only lichens and alpines and things at the top. And that exactly the same pattern emerges as you travel north and south away from the equator. There's a direct relationship between altitude and latitude in Humboldt's mind, and he starts correlating this kind of information, and Hooker is inspired by this vision that you can map the physical geography with the climate, the meteorology, the temperature and pressure, rainfall, soil types, the geology. All these things can be brought together into a single kind of grand synthesis that will allow you to understand the history of the Earth, including the history of its plants.
But to establish reliable botanical laws, Hooker needed specimens, lots of them from all over the globe. He plotted these on his flora maps to build up an accurate picture of natural resources. He had no funding, but he did have his father's extensive list of contacts from all over the world. Many unpaid enthusiasts contributed, some of whom he'd met on his extensive travels, like the Reverend William Colenso. He was a missionary based in New Zealand, and here at Kew, the economic botany collections have a number of gifts that Hooker received from Colenso. These reveal Colenso's close ties with the Maori, their culture and their plants. They testify too to his friendship with Hooker that was to last over 50 years. Mark Nesbitt is the collections curator.
Colenso collected over 6,000 herbarium specimens, but he also collected lots of examples of useful plants, because of course Kew had that really strong interest in uses of plants at the time. So this is a bottle gourd, and these were used by the Maori for carrying water and for drinking from. But this is a really special example because of this massive engraving that's all over it. On the front, what you can see here is a moko. This is the facial tattoo that many Maori men bore and still wear today. You can see the mouth, you can see the eyes, you can see the sort of spiral tattooing. And this is individual. This moko identifies an individual. It's highly unusual to see it carved actually onto an object. Because this is almost certainly done as a gift for Colenso by Maori with whom he was friends, but essentially it's a souvenir. But
a memory of his face.
He wasn't an easy man, but he had a lot of respect for Maori and for their culture. And so, for example, he wrote something that's very unusual for a 19th century scientist to write. He writes about place names. It really bothered him that botanists always got the place names their plants were growing incorrect. And these are Maori place names, of course. He argues that such errors about place names should not be left uncorrected because language adheres to the soil. When the lips which spoke it are resolved into dust, mountains repeat and rivers murmur, the voices of nations denationalised or extirpated in their own land.
What you really need to be a good collector, of course, is to know what's in flower when and where. And it's only by living in the colony for many years that these gentlemen have that degree of expertise. Many of them, I think, have a sort of just a passion for scientific collecting. They want to be contributors to science. Colenso very much has that kind of goal in mind. And I think loneliness is an important motivator for somebody like Colenso. He's the only white man for miles around, certainly the only white man with any interest in science for much of the time. And having somebody he can really talk to about his interests is a rare treat. And I think that's a powerful motivator for someone in that position.
But the relationship between the amateur in the field and the professional practitioner back at Kew wasn't always easy. Colenso and others would work tirelessly to Hooker's exacting requirements about where to look and how to select and present specimens. But tension arose over how to name the plants once they had been found. Hooker firmly favoured a growingly popular natural system of classification, which used all the features of the plant. Colenso and his fellow collectors, those who were actually getting their hands dirty down in New Zealand, understandably prided themselves on their local knowledge. They felt they knew the local plants better than anyone else, certainly better than those in the metropolis. But Hooker wasn't having any of it. Herbarium sheets in hand, he wrote to Colenso.
From having no herbarium, you have described as new some of the best-known ferns in the world.
It's not as clear-cut as it sounds, because what Hooker is doing is comparing New Zealand's ferns to ferns from all over the Southern Hemisphere. And he can see there's a kind of gradual series which one form blends into another. So if you look at the series as a whole, spread out on the floor here in the herbarium, there are no sharp breaks. And if there are no sharp breaks, you can't justify making a species in Hooker's mind. Whereas Colenso is looking at only the forms in New Zealand, but he's looking at living specimens, not dried ones. And he argues there are things you can see in the living plant that are lost when the plant is dried, and that he actually has a more detailed understanding. On one occasion, when they're arguing about the native New Zealand flax, Phormium tenax, Colenso actually says, well, no Maori would use one variety in place of another. They are quite distinct in the mind of the Maori, therefore they're different species. Well, from Hooker's perspective, he's trying to get a global overview of vegetation. The fact that Maori use this one for mats and that one for hats is neither here nor there, as far as he's concerned. Colenso has a different set of priorities.
So Hooker basically has a different concept of what a species is to Colenso.
He certainly does, and botanists describe these two different views as being a lumper or a splitter. Hooker is the lumper to end all lumpers. He loves to get rid of species and lump them together into bigger, broader categories. And lots of variability is the definition of a species as far as he's concerned. There's a lovely letter he writes to his friend George Bentham when they're working here at Kew, and he's describing their work on the floor of India a few years later. And Hooker writes, "It is wild and exciting work. The species go smash, smash every day." And you can see this delight in getting rid of some of the millions of sheets of specimens he's got to keep track of, the millions of descriptions, of the millions of words of Latin descriptions that he has to do. abolishing a species is a great benefit. So Hooker wants to concentrate authority here, literally here in the herbarium, as much as he can. And there's a reason for this, which I think is to do with mapping the distribution of species. One of the key tools that Hooker actually uses, which he borrows from Robert Brown, is called botanical arithmetic, which is basically an early way of calculating what we would now call biodiversity. The ratio of species to genera in a particular place gives you a sense of how rich its flora is. But of course, if everyone has a different sense of how many species there are and names them on a different basis, you can't do the sums. You can't do the sums, you can't get the laws. So it's really fundamental.
During the late 1850s, Darwin was at work on what he called his Big Species book. He regularly asked Hooker for help in analysing plant classifications. Darwin's suspicion was that in large genera, natural selection would act upon species with many varieties and gradually develop them into multiple new species. However, Darwin also constantly emphasised how slowly evolution progresses, from which Hooker concluded that many human lifetimes must pass before minor variations would evolve into genuinely separate species. For Hooker, then, Darwin's work on natural selection reinforced his predilection for lumping. Meanwhile, away from the agonised debate, the herbarium kept on growing. In 1865, when Joseph Hooker had succeeded his father, William, as director, the herbarium had 150,000 species. As far as Hooker was concerned, this was now the beating heart of Kew.
The herbarium gave Hooker the power to see the world at a glance, spread out on his table at his feet. He could see the patterns of the world's plants, the variety of them, the distribution, what grew where and why, which ones could be compared, which ones could be lumped into a single species and so on. The world became manageable. Here in the herbarium, the chaos of nature is reduced to order.
It's a powerful image, an ordered world visible at his feet. Like William Blake the poet, Hooker could see a world in a grain of sand, nature remade in the image of the empire. For Hooker, like many men of Victorian science, the point of understanding the world was to change it in ways that reflected Britain's interests, as well as serving their own. His herbarium now had the authority to help map vital resources, identify new ones, and help move them between colonies. But it was also a tool in the battle for botanists' claim to be taken seriously. By helping to shed light on the origin of species, Joseph Hooker was now transforming botanists from mere species mongers, little more than librarians, into respectable men of science.
Plants From Roots to Riches was presented by Professor Cathy Willis. The readers were Ian Redford, Clive Hayward, and Jane Slaven. The producer was Adrian Washbourne. Now, before we join Philippa Thomas for the world tonight, a look at the weather. Any mist and fog patches will slowly clear through the morning. Otherwise, tomorrow will be another day of sunny spells and showers. However, with lighter winds, the showers will be slow moving and heavy in places, with the risk of hail and thunder. Early fog patches will clear on Sunday morning to leave a day of sunny spells and isolated showers, but thickening cloud and some rain may push into some southern parts later. On 92 to 95 FM, 198 Longwave, on digital radio and online. This is BBC Radio 4.